While taking care of a chronically ill loved one is always a daunting task, there can be many added layers when the caregiver and the patient are spouses. And we're going to learn about that very complex relationship and experience as we visit with Susan Allen Toth. She is the author of many books, including the recently released No Saints Around Here, A Caregiver's Days. She was a longtime teacher and writer in residence at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. She divides her time between rural Wisconsin and La Jolla, California. With us today by phone, Susan, welcome to the Ideas Network. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here.
Great to have you. Your husband, James, was quite a few years older than you, and actually, James actually tried to talk about the fact that you might end up as his caregiver.
Yes and no. James was 15 years older than I, but when I married him, and right up until the last few years of his Parkinson's, when, as happens often with not all the time, but with Parkinson's patients, they can eventually also develop dementia. So the Parkinson's and dementia, of course, slowed him down. Up until, I would say, you know, his mid-70s, he moved a lot faster and with more energy than I do or did, and I usually am very energetic. So he was quite, he didn't actually want to talk to me about caregiving as such. Towards the, he did not even want to talk about dying until we were very close to the end. He did occasionally say to me, "What is going to happen?" And I would say something along the lines of, "I don't know what is going to happen. You are older than I am, and statistically, you will probably leave for the farther shore before I do. But you also have Parkinson's, which is a chronic and progressive disease, and that makes the future quite uncertain. I could be hit by a bus tomorrow." I would say that with absolute truth because life, I've learned, is so unpredictable. And he would wince. And I'd say, "I'm hoping that's not going to happen. But since we don't know exactly what the future holds, and you don't with a chronic progressive disease, I said, we're just going to keep going." And we kept going.
Yeah. And you kept a diary is not the...
No, it wasn't really a diary.
No, it wasn't.
But it's a little hard to describe because most writers that I've heard of keep journals. I've never been able to keep a journal. Even back when I was a child and was given one of those little diaries with a lock and a key, I would keep entries for maybe a week or two, and then I'd give up. And when years later I went back, my entries were idiotic. They were things like, you know, "Met Bob and Jim at the swimming pool. Gee." So as I got older, I would occasionally, thinking writers need to keep journals, I would try this. And then I would get depressed because I found I was only putting down rather negative things. So when I reread these entries, it sounded as though I were gloomy and had headaches and was worried every minute of the day. I gave the whole thing up. But during James's illness, I had stopped writing, basically. I kept writing as writers always do, with emails and jotting little notes to myself. But I decided when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, about 10 years before he died, that I did not want to be saying to him, "I'm sorry, we can't do that. I have to go up to my study and work on X project."
Yeah.
So I didn't write anything of significance for those 10 years. And as his disease progressed, I found that I simply had to express some of the conflicting feelings, some of what I thought at the time were trivial incidents that caused me to have much more than trivial reactions. And one of the ways one can do this, if you're a caregiver, is to talk to other caregivers. This was immensely helpful. when I could call up a friend who was caregiving for her husband, and I would say, you won't believe what I just had to do. And she would listen, and she would laugh, and she'd say, huh, you think that's something? Let me tell you what I just did. And another friend would call up and simply say, Susan, I'm on the brink. Talk me off the brink. But besides having that little circle of caregivers who understood in ways that no one else could, I wanted to be able to write about what was happening. That's what writers do to try to make sense of things. And so during those 18 months, I didn't have time to keep a journal. I would occasionally, I'd think over a topic in my head, and I would get an hour or two when I had an aide helping, and I would escape to a nearby shopping mall, which had a couple of corners with tables and chairs. I'd get a cup of decaf, and I would sit there with my portable computer and work on an essay. When I had time, I would polish it. So these were not journal entries in the usual sense. Mm-hmm. They are short essays, carefully thought out, written over those 18 months, sometimes at intervals of weeks, sometimes even longer, sometimes clumped a little bit together. And they cover topics that I wished I had been able to hear or read about in other caregiving books. I wanted to write something from the trenches, which said exactly how you feel, which, of course, at a great deal of the time, you feel angry, frustrated, guilty. You sometimes feel extremely loving. You feel sad. You feel tormented. You feel grateful that you are doing the best you can. And then the next moment, you feel you're not doing the best you can. I wanted to write, I think maybe a typical chapter I could describe is called Teeth Torture Time.
And this is about, I remember that chapter, yeah.
Well, this interestingly enough, several readers of this book, whom I've met at some book events, have come up to me to say this was the task they, too, hated more than anything else. They could handle, having been, most of them having been mothers, having dealt with their shares of messes, they could handle anything. But when it came to brushing and flossing your husband's teeth, and especially if your husband has Parkinson's and can't stand still easily, especially if he hates it, so he kind of jogs around and bobs, and so your electric toothbrush hits his sensitive parts, and then he spits things out, and there you are with your face next to his teeth, and you both are hating every minute of it. I think I when I wrote about this, and you may remember this, I would just sing this little ditty set to an old radio show, Howdy Doody Time, which I'm sure you are far.
Oh, yes.
Oh, well, when I was young, I listened to this avidly. And so I would sing, I would make up verses. You know, this is teeth torture time. Oh, we hate this time. We hate teeth torture time. But we have to do this now. We want to keep your teeth. We want to keep your teeth. You don't want to be just gums. You don't want to be just gums. And then, you know, this would help get me through it, just as it helped when I was fixing food. I have a chapter called Gravy. This is another one that has elicited comments from others saying, oh, you too? It sounds, these things, they sound really trivial. Brushing your husband's teeth, no big deal. Well, it was. And in Gravy, I talk about trying to feed James. That is, not just the physical act, which towards the end it was involved, but the preparing of meals that he would eat. Because many people with Parkinson's or other forms of illness that can also involve dementia, their taste buds change, literally. And what they might like today, they won't like tomorrow. And when you put something in front of them that you've worked hard on because the person you love is losing weight, and you know this person needs to be eating, and this person kind of shoves the plate aside and says, often quite pleasantly, I don't prefer this. It can drive you wild. And I talk about going into the kitchen and sticking out my tongue at the refrigerator and making terrible faces because it wasn't James's fault, but I felt angry. So that was the kind of thing I wrote about. I also, of course, wrote about some of the larger topics. How do you handle talking about dying? And we did this at the end. I talked in metaphors, and everyone who cares for someone who is dying has to take, I think, a lead from that person. Some don't want to talk about it. Some want to pretend it isn't happening. I didn't feel it was my job to try to introduce this topic until he did. And then he did. One day, and this would have actually been, let's see, we have an anniversary in February. He died in June. So this would have been many months before he died. My aide who was helping that day came up to me in the morning. It happened to be that day, our 25th wedding anniversary. And she came up and said, James says he thinks he's dying. This was the first time I had heard him use that word. And he hadn't used it to me. So I said, okay. I went downstairs to the room I had set up as a kind of hospital room. And I said, Marie says that you've told her you think you are dying. And he kind of nodded. And in this case, I said, well, I really don't want you to die today because this is our 25th wedding anniversary and it would break my heart. And he said, okay.
Oh, my goodness. That is one of the many stories that are in the book that Susan Allen Toth has written. And she's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. The title of the book, No Saints Around Here, A Caregiver's Days. And we have lots more to talk about with her. So please stay with us. News next, then we'll be back with our guest. For better or for worse, in sickness and in health is a nice sentiment that's included in many marriage vows, but until you are the caregiver for a chronically ill spouse, it can be hard to realize the depth of that promise. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Susan Allen Toth shares her very personal, very honest reflections on caring for her husband, James, as he lived with Parkinson's disease and its related dementia. In her book, she wrote No Saints Around Here, A Caregiver's Days. Besides being an author, she's a longtime teacher and writer in residence at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. Susan divides her time between rural Wisconsin and La Jolla, California. And once again, Susan, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure because I wrote this book not only to get my own feelings out, but also I really hoped it could reach other caregivers and tell them that they are doing the best they can and to assure them that guilt does go with caregiving, that you just have to look it in the face, put it aside, and move on. So it's a wonderful feeling for me to be able to share these memories of mine and these stories, hoping that they will connect to other caregivers. Oh, I should probably make one very modest correction. You'd have no way of knowing this, but I have been retired for some years from my post at McAllister, though I am always pleased to have it mentioned, but I'm no longer there in any capacity, and they're doing just fine without me.
Okay, well, I'm telling you, I can see why you were the writer in residence, because you've written a very wonderful book here, and it's a very honest. I mean, there were times. My mother had Alzheimer's and died of Alzheimer's, and my sister left her work and retired and went to and lived with my mother and cared for my mother for the, all the years that she was.
Oh, my.
So I'm reading the these chapters with a certain knowledge and then saying, you know, this is probably something my sister went through that I wasn't aware of because she never let it on. And so it's a very, for me, it's a very personal book in many ways. And so I can imagine a caregiver, a real caregiver, unlike me, who was there, you know, occasionally or as compared to what my sister was. Let's put it that way. I know you and James went through the very difficult process. And this is one of the chapters that really got to me. Watching people who had been very close to James, friends, family, former students to whom he had been a mentor, really distanced themselves. And in I think in your more charitable moments, what were your thoughts and feelings?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned some of my charitable moments because there were lots of moments when I wasn't feeling very charitable. I rationally understood that it is extremely difficult to visit someone who is before your eyes beginning to dwindle, beginning, in fact, to die, even though in James's case this was a long, slow process. None of us like to face the fact of our mortality, and I think that's part of it. Part of it is the very individual part of watching someone you knew in full possession of his energies and faculties slowly fading is very painful. It's extraordinarily painful for the caregiver, but the caregiver is watching this day by day, minute by minute, and while it's extraordinarily difficult, you don't have the sudden shock that someone who hasn't seen, in my case, my husband,
yeah,
for some time will experience upon paying a visit. It was surprising to me, and I understand again from other caregivers, this is quite common, that friends evidently are able to rationalize to themselves why they really can't come this week or next week. I think they sometimes say to themselves, what kind of conversation can I really make when James isn't able to respond very fully, and towards the end, virtually to respond at all. Though we were very, very blessed in that even towards the end, to the very end, he always knew who I was. There would be a gleam in his eye when someone he loved leaned over him or took his hand. He was not gone until he was actually gone. But we never know, I think, with people who suffer this way, how much they do understand and hear. And I so wished that someone could come, some of his longtime friends could come and sit and talk perhaps just about themselves. This is what I did today. This is what's coming up in my garden. This is the project I'm working on, whatever. Knowing that he or she was not going to get a very lengthy or organized response. James was a very social man. He loved company. I'm quite an introvert, actually, and get along without company pretty well. But he was so used to being a gregarious, outgoing man whose company was much treasured. He told wonderful, terrible, shaggy dog stories. He was always the first to jump up when someone wanted to give a toast, and he would give spontaneous, heartfelt toasts. He had a marvelous sense of humor, and part of him always remained about 14. That part sometimes, you know, really irritated me, but it was also kind of wonderful to live with. So he was a joyous man, and to see him feeling, I know, often lonely. It helped that we had wonderful aides, kind of a team who changed and came and went, most of them not trained as aides. I would train them in, so to speak, And they all were women. He liked women. And thank goodness. So I you know, never had to worry about his saying, as I know some other spouses have said to their wives, no, I can't let her do that. That's, you know, too intimate a task, or words along that line. James accepted what needed to be done with just enormous dignity. And it was an innate dignity, and which was part of his personality. He wasn't a saint either, and no. I try to make that plain too. That some of the times I got irritated, I was, you know, the irritation was probably justified, but we both knew neither one of us was a saint, and that helped keep us going. Yes, I would imagine that your mother also experienced, I hope I'm wrong, mm-hmm. a huge drop-off in friends who would come and visit.
Yes. I'm you know, in the end, probably almost none.
Yep.
Some relatives, certainly. But, that is indeed the case. And I was kind of struck when, and I was kind of glad you, I was happy you said this to this one individual.
Oh, yes. And I will.
Who called and would never come.
Yes. He had been almost like a son to James. And I change all the names in the book. So even if someone listening to this might have known this person if I said the name, and I don't even remember what name I gave him, but it wasn't his real name. He had been a student of James's. He'd worked for him. He had been very, very close to James and his family as the family were growing up. This is before I knew James, of course, because this was a second marriage for both of us. And he lived in an East Coast city, and he used to call James, or James would call him very regularly. They'd have these wonderful, long, chatty conversations, and very occasionally, if James were on the East Coast, he would have a chance to visit with this much younger friend. But as time went on, this friend who came to the Twin Cities not often, but enough to visit his own aging and eventually dying parents, this friend, knowing what was happening to James, did not come to see him. He would call. He would make these calls. And eventually he would talk to me because it was hard for James to keep up a conversation. And James would always look so eager when I would say, "It's so-and-so on the phone, honey." And he would reach for the receiver, and they'd have a slightly halting conversation. Then I would take the phone, and this guy would say, "Tell me how he's doing. How's he feeling?" And at one point, I said, "Look, if you are not going to come to see James before he dies, then do not bother to come to the funeral," which was harsh.
Yeah.
Now, really, kind of the stunning postscript to that is he did come to the funeral.
Ah, he did.
He did. He flew all the way from this East Coast city, came to the funeral. He didn't really talk to me. He talked to the now, of course, very grown and older children from James's first marriage, whom he knew, who all greeted him warmly. And I'm kind of glad he didn't greet me warmly, because I would have said, "Where the hell were you?"
Yeah. 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 I was glad you, when I read that, I thought, good for Susan.
Now, one of my readers proposed recently, when I was answering questions after a reading, a solution I wouldn't have had the courage for. But she said, in this case, she was not caring for a spouse, but for a parent. And this was the same situation. The parent was lonely. Visitors were absent. She made a list of her mother's, or maybe this was her father's, closest friends. She called them all up, and she said, "Okay, I want you to come, unless you have a good excuse, next Tuesday for 15 minutes from 10:15 to 10:30. You don't have to have much of a conversation. You can do all the talking, but my father needs to see you. Can you come?" Very few people, I think, said, no. And many of them returned once they saw they could do this.
Yeah.
But I didn't have the courage to do that.
Well, you did try a letter.
A circle. A caring circle. I was told that this was quite wonderful. And I sent out an email to a small group, again, of very dear, and in this case, all younger friends, and said, if you could just visit every 6 weeks or so, a month every 6 weeks for a short time, this would mean so much to both of us. And none of them came.
Not a one.
Not a one. Although those who were still living here came to the funeral. I have this kind of thing about funerals, actually, which is if you haven't paid attention during a person's lifetime, for whose sake are you going to that funeral? And do it now. And then, that is, do that visiting now, and then go to the funeral with a good heart.
Yeah, yeah. I know exactly what you're saying. I was thinking about an experience that I had with a dear friend who, a good friend who, in some fashion, just got apart, estranged in a way.
Yeah, it happens.
And she had brain cancer. Was diagnosed later with it, and I went to see her and spent about 3 hours with her talking and just reminiscing about what we had done together over the years and fun things that had occurred to both of us. And she wasn't really able to talk anymore, but she was listened and when I said, well, can I come back and see you again? She said, yes. And then she died about a week later.
Oh, my.
But I...
bravo for you.
I was really happy that I had decided to do that.
And, absolutely.
But you're right. It's not the easiest thing in the world, even though I'm someone who's pretty good at talking most of the time, to have a one-way conversation essentially for several hours.
Yes.
But I could look in her eyes and know that she was there in part.
Yes, yes. And that is a wonderful thing to remember. And aren't you glad you did it?
Oh, yes, for sure. For sure. And I have not given, we're having such a wonderful conversation. I haven't even given the phone number. I have to apologize. As you listen, I'm sorry I haven't given you a cue to call in. And I'll do that quickly for one or two calls. If you'd like to join in, maybe you have an experience to share. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your own questions or comments. You're such a lovely speaker, Susan. I think people are really enjoying just sitting and listening to what you have to say.
Oh, I hope so, because, as I said, I really want to be an encouraging voice to all those other caregivers. I just had an extremely moving letter from a woman who is 86, caring for her husband, who has Parkinson's with dementia. He's 82. There are exacerbating factors going on. And she spoke about how she gets comfort from her cat, who curls up and purrs, and whom she can stroke. Because I write also, there's a chapter in this book about it's called Sleeping with a Wombat, which I won't try to explain, but it's about the loss of physical touch. I'm not just talking sex here. I'm talking physical closeness and warmth. And when your husband is in a hospital bed with sides on it so that he can't fall out of bed, believe me, there's not much room for you to get into that bed.
Yeah.
So it's one of the great losses you experience, and you do what you can. But it's an experience filled with loss and also filled with love, because you do get to realize the depth of the love that you have for this person.
Yeah. Now, Nate and Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. So So I had a close neighborhood friend who had a terminal disease, and I made a special effort to visit with him as much as I could before he passed. And one of the things that I've struggled with since then is I don't go and visit with his surviving spouse after he's gone. And I wonder, you know, often does she feel, you know, everyone was coming over then, and now no one comes over anymore, and it's just me. And I just wonder, would like comments or thoughts on that.
Oh, I wouldn't feel guilty about that at all. I am all for not feeling guilty, as you can see. Although I always resonate when I see, I haven't seen this for years, a bumper sticker that says, my mother was the travel agent for guilt trips. So I know about guilt. But in this case, it was the neighbor you were closest to, that is the person you were visiting. And his wife, I must say women usually have a resource that men don't, which is a circle of women friends. I'd bet anything that she kept that circle of friends and that they are the ones to whom she can probably speak most openly and most intimately. And you were there when it counted. You'll probably never know what it meant to her that you came and paid that attention. But unless you had a really close relationship with that woman, I would think she may be actually relieved not to have to entertain you. I am, you know, something of an introvert, and when I've done some kind of public appearance, I retreat for quite a while to kind of catch my breath. She's probably catching her breath. You could always drop a note in her mailbox and say, I often am thinking of you, and if there's anything I can do for you here in the neighborhood, let me know.
Mm, that's not a bad idea.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nate, for calling. And Ken in Kokana, hi.
Hi, Larry. I would like to thank you and both of your guests this morning, and I just want to mention that every county in Wisconsin, every one of the 72 counties, has an aging and disability resource center. They're working with and for families that are struggling with caregiving issues and with Alzheimer's issues.
Oh, and Susan, a comment from you on that?
I think that's a wonderful resource. And caregivers do need to, if they hear something like this, to exploit every possible resource they can. I did try, but partly because of who my husband was, I once tried taking him to a Parkinson's day group, and he hated it. He came home, and he said, I think I'm being punished for having Parkinson's. I said, okay, you don't have to go back there. We will figure something else out. But to know that there is that kind of resource available, and perhaps our caller can tell us, how would people access this resource?
Well, aging and disability resource centers are typically part of the aging organization in a county, the Health and Human Services Department. If they have a computer, they can go online and look for the ADRC, which is the acronym for Aging and Disability Resource Center.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ken, for calling and for your comments. And, boy, Susan, thank you so much for writing this book, No Saints Around Here. I found it just a very enlightening read for me. And I know every caregiver and every person who may be in that position or have a loved one caring for somebody or a friend caring for someone should read this.
Because... Thank you. And you tell your sister she is a heroine.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Susan Allen Toth is the author of many books, including No Saints Around Here, A Caregiver's Days. Great to have her with us, and thank you so much for listening in. Tomorrow, you know what? Tomorrow's Wednesday, and it's the first Wednesday of the month, and that means Scott Craven joins us to take a look at the world of wildlife. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.